The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman. I'm a producer and editor here in the author events office. And tonight I forgot my glasses, so bear with me when I am introducing our author, Haroon Mogal. Haroon Mogal's many books include My First Police State, The Order of Light, and How to Be Muslim, An American Story, referred to by the Washington Post as a profound and intimate memoir about life in the United States during the immediate aftermath of 9/11. A former member of the cohort of the Muslim Leadership Initiative, a fellow in Jewish-Muslim relations at the Shalom Hartman Institute of North America, a Friday preacher and public speaker, Mogal's writing investigates the intersections of pop culture, faith, futurism, philosophy, and more. He has contributed essays to the New York Times, The Guardian, CNN, Foreign Policy, and NPR's Fresh Air, among several other media outlets. He joins us tonight with his book, 2 Billion Caliphs, A Vision of a Muslim Future. In it, Mr. Mogal uses a Muslim perspective to answer some of life's biggest questions and to address Islam's misunderstood past, its present challenges, and the hope that it can offer for the future. One review proclaims that, quote, Mogal's candid mix of devotional and memoir make this a solid primer on Islam, and that, jumping from religious textual analysis to personal stories, the blend of sacred and secular has its charms, as does Mogal's straightforwardness and optimism for Islam's future. Tonight's author will be in conversation with Adnan A. Zulfikar. Mr. Zulfikar is a legal historian working on Islamic law, criminal law, and law in the global south, with specific interests in legal obligation, jihad and revolution, policing, and criminal codes. He previously helped draft and implement criminal codes in the Maldives and Somalia. He regularly provides expert media commentary for various outlets, is proficient in multiple languages, and has spent over a decade in the Middle East, South Asia, and Sub-Saharan Africa. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, join me in welcoming Haroon Mogal and Adnan A. Zulfikar to the Free Library.
First, let me begin by thanking all of you for coming out. I know it's a beautiful day out, and so being inside the Free Library may not be the first choice, but I assure you it's going to be an interesting event and conversation, and we're looking forward to having you all part of it as well. So you have an introduction of who we are. You have an introduction of certainly who our author is. We have known each other for quite a long time, so this conversation in some respects is going to pick up on that relationship. We've known each other almost 24 years or so?
24 years.
Yeah, so it's been fascinating for me watching Haroon's intellectual journey, so I'm going to probe a little bit there as well. The evening, I'm going to ask Haroon some questions, have a bit of a conversation. We're going to touch on some things that are a little substantive within the book. We'll touch on some things that are more personal within the book, and then we're hoping you all can join the conversation as well. So let me start this off with the fact that this is now, I believe, your fourth book, right?
Yes.
Your third nonfiction book. There's a fiction book in there as well.
Yeah, don't read that one.
Yeah, so it is actually a good book. So, and so my question I want to start off with is this book, 2 Billion Caliphs, had this always been on your mind, or did it come about later? And if it came about later, why? Why did it come about? So let's start off there.
Sure. Well, good evening, everyone. It's very nice to be in Philadelphia. I got here this morning via Charlotte, which is the Queen City, which it never occurred to me. I recently moved to Cincinnati. Cincinnati is also the Queen City. So America is nothing if not redundant. But certainly it's nice to go from city to city and get to meet folks and talk about a book that is very important to me. So thank you for coming out. And I will say that books seem to happen to many people I talk to who write in rather inadvertent or surprising ways. So, you know, as Adnan mentioned, we met each other way back in the late 1990s when I was in college in New York City. He was in college, or I think he maybe just finished, in Atlanta. And, you know, we kind of struck up a friendship and it grew from there. And actually, Adnan, I should say, first encouraged me to get into writing. There were not a lot of people of my background. My family, like his family, is from Pakistan originally. And most of us from our generation, given our parents' backgrounds and so on and so forth, we were expected to be doctors. And if not doctors, then doctors. So certainly writing was a peculiar choice. And I wrote a lot and tried my hand at it. And had a really prolific period in my early 20s, pushed out two books, a travelogue and a work of fiction. And then kind of threw myself into punditry and commentary. And ended up in my mid-30s in a pretty tough spot and felt myself entirely exhausted by my religious identity. And what I mean by that is that I found myself in a place where the pressures of living up to being a certain public face for conversations about Islam took away a lot of my own ability to figure out my own identity. And so rather tongue-in-cheek, I wrote a memoir that was quite serious, but the title was a bit sarcastic. It was called How to Be a Muslim, an American Story. We subtitled it an American Story because apparently readers might think that if the word Muslim was in the title, it could have nothing to do with America, but I suppose we have to be careful of these things. And we titled it How to Be a Muslim because it was very much the story of how I tried and tried and tried to be a certain kind of Muslim and why I thought I failed so many times to realize that kind of spiritual identity. So, all well and good, the book was published, and there was a bit of a problem. Many people seemed to think the book was actually a guide to how to be a Muslim. And so, early on, I remember looking at the Amazon ratings a little obsessively, and I noticed that the book most often bought with this book was A is for Allah, which is a children's book and not a painful, dark memoir of a man in his mid-30s trying to figure out how his life had gone wrong. And so there were a lot of disappointed parents, I'm sure, out there, a little bit curious as to what their children were reading. And I went to a lot of events, and people would literally walk out in 5 minutes because they were like, this is nothing to do with how to be a Muslim. I was like, yes, thank you. Can you help me?
Right.
And so long story short, it planted the seed in my mind that maybe I should write a book about what it means to be a Muslim. But as I thought about it, and I've spent now 20 years in a position of publicly talking about and exploring Islam with American and international audiences, one thing I realized over and over again is a lot of introductions to Islam do a very good job of explaining what and when and where and how. What they don't do is why, right? Why do people act the way they act? Why do people prioritize the things they prioritize? What are the underlying motivations behind the life choices people make? And it struck me as a grave injustice and, frankly, a dangerous reality that we in America know so little about the motivations and worldview and perspectives of what is now almost one out of four people on the planet, and probably by the year 2070, from what I've seen, about one out of three people on the planet. And certainly, you know, if we look at what's happening in Ukraine, for example, many people, you know, are surprised when political realities turn into crises because of a national conversation that often doesn't pay enough attention to the rest of the world or diversity within our own context, and also a national conversation that does a very poor job of explaining motivations and rationalization. So in some ways, it's a very recent product of where I find myself, but in many ways, it's the product of 20-something years of just thinking about what it means to be Muslim and trying to explain to people from all different backgrounds, this is why many Muslims do things that might seem unfamiliar or unusual, but actually emerge from a very deep and intense and compelling worldview.
So that's fascinating to me, because when you started off answering it, I thought, okay, that's interesting. There are these audiences to your last book, many of them, it sounds like, who were Muslim, and they came away thinking, hey, this isn't quite how to be Muslim. And so I thought maybe you're going in a direction to say the audience here is, if you will, somewhat internal, yet at this, the rest of your remarks suggest that it's really an external audience that you're aiming for. So I guess if I could ask, when you were writing this book, who did you have in mind? Who did you think, or who did you want to be reading this? Was it internal audiences, you know, young Muslims growing up, or their parents who wanted that book that you never wrote? Was it external audiences who maybe needed to know more about Islam or Muslims in your view? Was it a mixture of both? You know, who did you have in mind?
Yeah, so, you know, when I emailed my editor at Beacon, I can tell the whole long story at some point. It's a wonderful tragedy of a child who was told he was going to the Ivy League and did not. So it's a story of nauseating privilege and entirely irrelevant to most people's realities. So anyway, long story short, I emailed the editor and said, I have this great idea. What if I write a short book, you know, like a 200-page book that just really tries to communicate, this is the world's fastest growing faith. Whatever people make of that, whatever their own opinion of religion, certainly it matters if people in America understand or do not understand the dynamics that shape this incredibly sometimes chaotic, sometimes beautiful, sometimes challenging, sometimes confusing civilization and culture and all these different communities. And they jumped on it. They said, actually, that's a great idea. And I said, well, I'm not going to go into chronologies and definitions and things like that. I'm going to give you the concepts. Like, what are the ideas, the words, the grammar out of which Muslims construct and contest their understanding of the world? And so I started writing, and I looked at ideas that I thought were maybe undervalued or understudied. And as I was writing it, it occurred to me that, like, hey, actually, for Muslims in the West, in the United States and in North America and Europe especially, where we have a certain amount of distance from the sort of classical, so to speak, heartland of the Islamic world, maybe we can also do something a little bit different and return to the stuff out of which religion is made, and think about what it is we want to do with that heritage. And so, in a sense, the book is for a lot of different types of people. It's for people who are interested in religion and interested in understanding the wider world, understanding a part of the world and a part of our country that might be unfamiliar or unusual, or simply of curiosity. And certainly for young Muslims who are in this position, like I think, you know, you and I were, you know, like 5 years ago when we were in our 20s. And that would make college when we were three, but it's because right. We were in the advanced pre-med track. So the reason I mention that is because we were really asking ourselves those questions, right? Like, what does it mean to be a Muslim? Out of everything my parents and my community and my culture has given to me, what am I supposed to take? What am I supposed to leave to the side? What can I play with? What can I move around? What is fixed and immutable? And fundamentally, that's a universal story, but it just happens more and more frequently or rapidly as we move forward through time, where we have these disconnects, these chronological biases. And I think it's a beautiful overlap between the American tradition and the Muslim tradition, where we in America do that all the time, right? Are we going back to 1776? Are we going back to 1619? Are we going back to 1865? Like, what are the moments and ideas and concepts that shape who we are and who we want to be and who we should be?
So that's really interesting, you know, in terms of the role of history and kind of how we process that. And certainly as a law professor, I'm always trying to guide my students through that to some degree. Let me take that then and go in a particular direction with some of the substance, right? So there's a certain point where as I was reading your book, I thought, oh, like, you seem really resistant to the idea of authority within Islam. Like, almost in a kind of libertarian way, but, you know, that any type of authority, whether state authority, and even eventually it seems like even spiritual authority, as you can get into some, or, well, I'll ask you a little bit about that spiritual journey. But my question for you, if we kind of step now into a little more of the substance, is there no role for authority, right, and within Islam? Because when you say 2 billion caliphs, right, the idea that maybe suggested is that, well, 2 billion caliphs being sort of a caliph being the ruler or vicegerent of God, but the ruler of the political state, but having this kind of authority that, okay, you have 2 billion authority figures then, which then suggests to me You have 2 billion experts. And then what's the role of expertise within sort of Islam? And if you will, we can connect that to some of our broader conversations that we're having here in the United States around expertise in this world of social media and where, you know, everyone can Google search and then become the expert. So summing it up, what is the role, or is there any role of kind of authority within the vision of a Muslim future that you've laid out?
That's a big question. So how do I get at that? Because I think it's a great question, and when you gave me a hint of what you might ask me, you basically made sure I didn't sleep for 3 days. And I was like, oh, Adnan is really smart. Now I'm going to have to think of something that makes me sound smart. Also, Adnan thinks very highly of me because he's a law school professor and I went to law school for 3 weeks. So that's another common ground.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say because within the book, and we're going to get to that spiritual journey at a certain point, right? But you're really addressing political Islam.
Yes.
Right.
But not only political.
Not only political Islam, right? Yeah. But really, there's a real address to, hey, look, like, you've taken religion, you've made it very political, and you've done it by kind of stealing almost this prophetic mantle and authority.
Yeah.
And I want to take that back. I want to snatch that back. Seems to be that one of the core things, right?
Yeah.
But it's not just political Islam. You sort of come around to saying, well, there's some of these other authority figures, some of these religious figures as well, who maybe are asserting certain types of authority there. So I guess the first question is for you, like, you know, what's your issue with authority, right? Is it a libertarian thing? Is it, you know, where is that coming from, and what are you trying to address with this idea of authority?
Sure. So I'll try to answer this in a way that maybe is a little bit more relatable. So. Yeah. The first part of the answer is, I will say, as I sat down to write the book and map out the book, I said to myself, in order to understand how Islam sees the world, we have to understand what Islam thinks a human being is, right? Every ethical tradition, every worldview, every moral philosophy has an idea of what each of us in this room are, who we should be, what we could be. And in the Islamic tradition, the answer I gravitated to, and of course, like any massive, complicated historical phenomenon, Islam has different interpretations and answers, but what I return to is that there is this story in the second chapter of the Quran, which is probably broadly familiar to an American audience. It's the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. And the story is prefaced in verse 30 with God saying to the angels assembled in the garden that he is going to create a caliph on the earth, a khalifa. And a caliph, as you pointed out, it's an Arabic term, sort of essentially something like a representative, a steward, a custodian, to use legalese, maybe power of attorney, might not be too far off the mark. But effectively, the divine was creating a being to whom the divine would delegate a certain kind of authority. And some, maybe many in the Islamic tradition argue that it wasn't just Adam or Adam and Eve, it was all human beings potentially. So everyone in this room is potentially or actually, whether we would like to be or not, is a caliph, right? That we have a certain moral agency and moral responsibility. And so I said that to me explains who every single human being, who we are and why we do the things we do and why we have the obligations we do. And then it got me to thinking, why then do we see so little emphasis on individual agency and responsibility in Muslim spaces? Mm. We have a lot of talk about collective identity, totalizing identity, subsuming the individual into the whole. And that to me seems first a tragedy because it's taking away this critical part of every human being's dignity and status and accountability. But second, it also explains why Muslims often fail to bring about the outcomes they seem so passionately invested in. I was thinking about this earlier, and I think a good analogy might actually be to COVID, right? And bear with me here for a second, right? Prior to COVID hitting, right, I did not personally pay that much attention to public health issues. It's not my area of expertise or anything like that, but you know, I read from time to time, and I had read before COVID was upon us that the United States was believed to be the country most likely to survive a pandemic relatively unscathed. And I'm sure many of us in this room heard the argument that we had the best public health system in the world, we had the most resources, so on and so forth. And yet, in retrospect, and I'm saying this as someone who now lives in Ohio, where COVID lasted for about 3 to 6 weeks, and then we, you know, miraculously discovered our resistance to it, right? Like, nobody was wearing masks after a few months, right? And yet, in retrospect, it's not that surprising, because if you think about it, right, if you just reflect for a moment, American society is quite resistant to instruction from above, right? We don't do well with that. We do well if it's organic. Right, we have remarkable examples throughout our history of collective enterprise and endeavor and national commitment, but we also have a lot of instances where we push back very strongly and forcefully, even if it's good for us, because it's in our DNA. And actually, I think that there is a design feature in Islam which Muslims are not adequately aware of, which is that, one, the idea of individual moral responsibility, two, the idea of individual moral accountability, and three, the idea that after the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, there can never be a form of authority that has the divine stamp of approval, right? There are minority opinions that do disagree, but by and large, the majority of the Muslim world has held to the opinion that, you know, prophecy is done, and you're never going to find a leader or body or institution with that level of authority or expertise, right? And so I guess what frustrates me is that I feel like instead of leaning into and embracing this characteristic of Islam, we are constantly fighting against it. It is a Sisyphean task, because on the one hand, we're telling people there's no prophecy after Muhammad, peace be upon him, and you're all individually accountable to God. Now shut up and listen to what I'm telling you to do. Okay. And if you can only have you can't have all three of those things. And so it's the paradox of the modern Muslim world that the more emphasis we have on religiosity, the less unity we seem to have. And one can look at that as a negative, or one can look at that as simply a consequence of the nature of Islam, right? If you preach a religion that invests each individual with a certain amount of responsibility and accountability, I won't say authority, because I acknowledge that can be loaded and dangerous, because there is definitely a need for expertise. We just end up in a situation where we're constantly fighting against our own religious nature. Mm. And so not only do we do injustice to individuals, but we handicap ourselves. We prevent ourselves from realizing our potential. It's certainly something, going back to the analogy on COVID, America, we as a country and a society will have to think about, you know, if, God forbid, we face something like this again, in terms of a pandemic or some other national security issue that requires collective discipline of some kind, how do we do it in a way that respects our kind of cultural DNA and works with it as opposed to against it? And maybe that's impossible, I don't know, but I'm certainly trying to open the door to that.
Okay. Let me switch tracks a little bit. And I found there was one of the most powerful lines in your book, where you say, quote, "I could not worship a being in need of anything. I am too in need of everything," right? And it's not typically how sort of this idea of God's neediness, you kind of put it in almost a positive light. Whereas typically, this is one of the main critiques, right? Which comes, why is God so needy? Why does God need me to do this and that and all these obligations? So I'm just wondering if you can say more about this and, you know, I guess connect this to some degree. When I was reading those lines, I was thinking, oh, that, you know, you talk about, in particularly in your prior book, about kind of your journey through an atheistic period as well. But I'm just curious as to your arrival at this line. And, sure. And kind of thoughts behind it.
Sure. So, you know, by way of background, you know, I was born with certain congenital medical conditions. I don't know how they're treated now. From what I can tell, in some respects, the medicine has advanced considerably. But if I had been born, in 1900, I would have died within a few days of birth. And so, you know, I existed in this situation where I had these medical challenges. They were, in some ways, extreme limitations in what I could and could not do. Certainly, you know this, you know, but in terms of having the folks here understand, I was very conscious from a young age of the fact that I had physical limitations that many of my peers did not seem to have. Of course, we never know what anyone is going through in their personal life, but it seemed, you know, a restriction. I've had, I've lost count, I think 16 or 17 surgeries, a number of different, you know, medical procedures and treatments and this and that. And yet at the same time, I'm not trying to portray this as a story of hardship. Both my parents were doctors. We had, you know, networks and resources that enabled us to handle this in a way that, you know, I'm constantly conscious if I was born into a different family or a different place, I have no idea how I would have handled that, let alone how my parents would have handled that. And it certainly, you know, there's a larger commentary on healthcare in the United States or the lack of healthcare in the United States and the kind of lottery we live in. But so I was always conscious of the fact that I am not enough, right? That I need people to do things, you know, at times in my life that maybe a lot of other folks don't have that commensurate need. That said, I think our conversation in America about individual responsibility always kind of amuses me when you consider the fact that for most of our lives, we are pretty dependent, right? Other than this kind of golden period when you're in your 40s, right? Where you're like taking care of kids and maybe taking care of parents, right? And sort of you're like, there's like a double burden on you, right? Many points in your life, you really, I mean, when you're a child, you're mostly helpless. And when you, if you live long enough, then you live at a point where you need a lot of care around the clock. And I guess what I'm saying is, you know, we have this kind of narrative of autonomy, which I think is a fiction, and it's a dangerous fiction, right? Because that's just not how people live. It's never how we've lived. It's impossible for us individually, socially, so on and so forth. But what I think is interesting about it is that when we reflect on it, the Islamic tradition, this is something I try to do in the book all the time. I feel like a lot of Muslims, when we look at our texts, when we look at our tradition, we take the dullest possible meaning from a text, right? We don't really dig deep and say, like, what does this really mean? Mm. So I'll give you a simple example, and I'm sorry if I'm giving you too long of an answer, but I'm trying to explain something that might be unfamiliar to folks. So there's a chapter in the Quran. It's the 112th chapter. It is just four verses long, but it's one of the most significant chapters in the Quran. And effectively, it says in a very rudimentary English translation, God is one and unique. God is eternal and self-sufficient. He is neither a parent nor a child, and nothing can be the like of him. And so immediately what this seems to do is it implies that the divine is this very alien, different, strange thing, right? Now imagine that this is being circulated in 7th century Arabia, which is an even more lineage-based society than ours is, right? So to say that the divine is neither a parent nor a child means that, like, this is a being that exists entirely outside of the frame of reference where people literally were called, oh, father or oh, mother of so-and-so, oh, son or oh, daughter of so-and-so, right? Your entire identity is literally wrapped up in who your parents are and who your offspring are and what tribe you're from, right? That's it. There's no, like, independent identity outside of tribe or family. If you are outside of tribe and family, you're kind of effectively in a pretty crappy situation. And so why is the divine being described as so different? And many times you hear people outside the Islamic tradition describe God in the Islamic tradition as harsh, as uncompromising, as vindictive and vengeful. And that's not how Muslims experience the divine. And it occurred to me that actually what's happening in this chapter is the distancing is meant to underscore something, right? And actually, as I looked at more and more traditions, so for those who are familiar, the verse of the throne, the 155th verse of the Quran, second chapter of the Quran, you know, does the same thing. God is never tired, never sleeps, right? That God is so different from you. But why would the divine want to stress that? And it occurred to me that it's actually because it's indicating intimacy, right? People sometimes say to me, you know, why would God care if, you know, you pray this way or that way, right? And that's another conversation altogether. But then they'll say something like, God has more important things to do. No, he doesn't. Because importance is a question of capacity. If you are an omnipotent and exist outside of time and space, nothing is unimportant or, like, I mean, there are hierarchies, But it's not going to, you know, like, if I'm trying to, like, you know, do something at home and, you know, one of the kids comes and says, can you turn on the TV, right? I'm usually the one asking them to turn on the TV. I don't understand remotes anymore. Yeah. But, you know, let's pretend, right? Like, if they ask a trivial thing when you're doing a big thing, you have to say, like, hey, leave me alone for a minute, right? But if I'm omnipotent, I don't have to, like, you know, worry about the big thing and not worry about the small thing because I don't have any limitations. So what this passage is underscoring to me is this idea that the thing that I find so beautiful about Islam is that we are in a relationship with a divine who is so different from us that we are therefore constantly in contact with the divine because there are no, like, nothing else is competing for his attention because his attention is literally unlimited. And so it's not a question of a divine that is so different from us that we exist in a kind of relationship of absolute subservience. We exist in a state of constant consciousness. That you, wherever you are at any point or time in your life, right now, every single thought that has gone through your head, God is aware of that. Right? Whatever happens with that, I don't know. But the point is, nobody is any more or less important. And so the idea of hierarchy, of authority, the way we frame things, I think is nuanced or softened or changed by this idea that, yeah, like, I'm a being who is radically in need of a lot of things, right? Like, I am. I mean, I can't do a million things that I would need to do to survive. And yet, I live in a culture that preaches a narrative of, you know, I did it. Mm-hmm. I built it. I don't need anyone. People are taking from me, right? Whereas, you know, it's kind of silly. And then, so I'm trying to kind of shake at something that I think in our culture needs to be shaken a little bit, but I'm also trying to point to something in Islam that maybe a lot of Muslims sometimes don't realize the significance of. Namely, we have a tradition that encourages intimacy with the divine, not distance from the divine. And texts which emphasize distance are actually preaching intimacy.
So that's interesting because that, you know, there's a point in your book where you say total otherness makes total intimacy possible, which it seems like that's where you're getting at. And you do emphasize a lot this notion of Islam as a religion of intimacy, as a way in which, I think you say, anyone can reach out to God, that you're constantly in contact. And so then going back to our earlier question then about sort of authority and political Islam and maybe the things that you're observing in the world, when you're diagnosing the problem, what is it that... not all Muslims, but at least the Muslims who maybe you want to critique, maybe the ones who are in some of these arenas of political Islam or what have you, what are they doing that you feel is kind of countering that intimacy? Is it this kind of the desire for this, like some type of Islamic state? Is that disrupting that intimacy? Is it just the mixing of politics and Islam? Like, what is it that kind of, for you, is disrupting this intimacy and pushing folks away?
Well, I think certainly everything you said, these are all problems we have in our tradition. We have a community, or communities, I should say, where a lot of people are robbing certain Muslims of agency, of access to the divine. Sometimes it is a deliberate attempt. Sometimes it perhaps emerges out of ignorance. Maybe there are good intentions, but the consequences are the same. We don't empower people to take the journey towards the divine. We don't teach them that they have the right to take that journey. We don't give them the skills they need to move in that direction. So, you know, I'll give you a simple example. You know, when I was growing up, you know, my father would always say, you have to go to Harvard. And I'm like, you know, there are other schools in the world, right? And he's like, no, Harvard, right? And partially that was because, you know, he's an immigrant who is not aware of the landscape of American education. And he's also he exists in an unsettled state, right? Because he understands that he's in a place where he's not familiar with the norms and that people see him as other. And so he's constantly worried, will my children be secure here? So I think it was Ta-Nehisi Coates who said, I'm going to bungle it up, but you know, you work twice as hard for half as much, mm-hmm. right? And that's what he's pointing to, that you kind of have to go above and beyond just to tread water, right? Because no one's going to give you the benefit of the doubt. You're a person of color with a strange name, right? Mm. So you're automatically kind of operating from a deficit. And yet, when I look back on it, the thing that I admire about it is that, or what I appreciate about it, I should say, is that what he was effectively saying to me is that you can do anything anyone around you can do. In fact, you can exceed them. Now, that doesn't mean that like you have to force your kid to do like one thing, but the point is he was trying to instruct me in this, or empower me with this belief that like you're not any less than anyone else. You're gonna have to work twice as hard, and that's not fair, but you can. And what I want to see from Muslim communities is less emphasis on buildings and rhetoric and slogans and more on investing in people. You know, and where is the consciousness of what it's going to take to meet the needs of our community? You know, and I don't see that. And so I'll give you a simple example of the mosque I attend, right? Ramadan just finished at the end of April, and Eid is the holiday that closes the month of Ramadan. And we had over 3 separate prayer services, 7,000 people attend prayer services in suburban Cincinnati, Ohio, right? Which is crazy. Right, when I was growing up, our mosque had like 15 people, right? Like 3 of whom were my family, right? So it's surreal, you know, and people from everywhere. And then I'm sitting and looking around and I'm thinking, it's a beautiful building, don't get me wrong, you know, and God bless the people who put the energy and the effort into building it. But the amount of money it's going to take to keep that going, just the building, versus the amount of energy and resources the people in the building require, right? Where are we directing our resources? Mm. And that's a very simple example of, I think, a community that is more often concerned with externalities than internal capacities, right? The genius of Islam early on was empowering people and creating, you know, generations of very talented folks who could do lots of amazing things. And that's what I would like to see more of.
Okay. So we have a minute or so before I want to open it up to the audience. I have a couple more questions. I might bring them in the audience discussion. But let me throw this one out at you. I believe since you started writing this book, which was how many years now ago, you think?
I think it was almost 5 years ago.
Okay, so almost 5 years ago. Since that time, you have become a father to 3 stepkids through marriage, a couple of them teenagers, and, you know, clearly when children enter your life and where you sort of have an added responsibility now to these other human beings, it changes certain ways in which you look at the world. And so my question is, would you write this book any different now? Or would you add anything, or is there something you would take out? Is this book looking different if you were starting it, you know, let's say a year ago or something?
Yes.
And then the follow-up is how?
I would have to say that in one of the longest-running debates you and I have had, you were right.
Okay. I don't know what that is, but I'll take
it. We often talked about different elements of Muslimness, and I'll break them into 3. There's Muslim identity. You know, I'm proudly Muslim. I want the world to know I'm Muslim. There's Muslim community. You know, I work to build a sense of collegiality and fellowship, brotherhood and sisterhood among people of different backgrounds who share similar spiritual commitments. And then there's Muslim piety, this idea of worship. And the reason I paused when you asked your question is because this is the scariest thing I've ever done. It's actually legitimately terrifying.
Fatherhood.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it makes me see my parents and anyone who's a caregiver, an educator, in like a really heroic sense. Mm. You know, and it's funny because in my 20s and 30s, I mean, I spoke at the UN, CNN, New York Times. Like, I just, you know, I spoke in front of thousands of people, right? Like, it was very normal. And, you know, met world leaders, traveled, you know, across to five continents, this and that, and felt like an ambassador to Islam, and I was doing something. And yet none of that feels remotely as significant or momentous or dangerous as this. And when I say dangerous, what I mean is, what am I giving them? And I have to ask myself, what am I passing on? What in my family's history is worth sharing? What do I want to leave them with? And I see what my parents must have, a little bit of what my parents must have felt, right? Because it is really like, I mean, you're a father three times over. And it's funny, you know, so I, as you know, like, I'll close with this as a note to wrap everything together. When my medical conditions are a little out of control, you know, my routine changes. My father is 83. I don't tell him anymore if I'm not feeling well because it stresses him out. And he'll always say, I get so worried I can't sleep. And I'd be like, Abu, like, you living in Maryland, right? Like, what do you, like, you don't, like, I'm a 40, almost 42 years old, right? Like, I got this, right? You don't have to worry about it. And he's like, you don't understand. Right. And I didn't.
Right.
And recently one of our kids went with a very good friend and her friend's family on like a little spring break kind of thing. She's a good kid. There was no reason to be concerned. She got a cell phone, right? Like, we got location services on, right? Like, her mom is very responsible person. She went with her mom's sister as well, and then of course her friend, right? And she's in high school, right? Like, she actually needs these experiences of being somewhat on her own and building a sense of independence, seeing the world on her terms, discovering herself. And it was early in Ramadan, and, you know, we told her, like, we'd, you know, ping her, like, don't forget to pray, don't, you know, this and that, and she's good with that, right? And yet I couldn't pray with any focus, because it constantly in my mind was like, what if she needs help? There's no reason whatsoever for me to be worried, right? It's completely illogical, right? In a rational sense, like, what am I going to do? I'm like 800 miles away, right? Like, I have nothing to do. And yet I was like, wow, like, I can't even exercise, like, and, you know, prior to this, I would just jump into Ramadan as like, I'm just me and God talking to each other for like 4 hours, right? Which is this absurd luxury when you have responsibilities in the form of human beings around you. And so what I'll say is it's a very humbling exercise. And I feel like if I spend the rest of my life just focusing on this, it is more meaningful and more challenging and more important than anything that came before.
Okay. Well, I'm going to now open it up to the audience. If there are questions there, I can take them. Otherwise, I have a few more of my own that can fill in space if you still want to think through some. Yes, please.
Thank you. The Judeo-Christian religion emphasizes a moral code of the golden rule, doing to others. Is there a similar moral code for Muslims?
Yes. Yeah. There are a number of texts. You know, like a simple example that comes to mind. I mean, there are a number, but one is the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, tells his followers, "None of you is a believer if you go to bed with your stomach full and your neighbor is hungry. You know, none of you believes until he wants for his brother what he wants for himself." So there are certainly these kind of common threads. One of the most famous and tragically perhaps understudied statements of the Prophet is, you know, I was sent to perfect good character or beautiful character. So how you comport yourself, something in the Islamic tradition that's called adab, like A-D-A-B, literally character or comportment, is essential. And I'll share a brief, beautiful anecdote. I was reading a book by a German woman who became Muslim and what it was like in her context. And she shared a story where she met a wiser, older man who became a religious teacher for her. and he had some cats. And, you know, in many cultures, certainly in Muslim cultures, if you have a guest, you overfeed them, right? You, like, just ply them with food. And every time he had a guest, he would take a little morsel of food and give a little morsel to each cat. And she said, "Why are you doing that?" And he said, "I don't want them to feel bad that they're being left out." And to him, that was beautiful character. That was prophetic. That you should always think about everyone around you, whether human or not, when you, in anything. Mm-hmm. And so there is that common thread throughout the Islamic tradition, right? Think of others, treat them as you would want to be treated, and that is evidence of the genuineness or the insincerity of faith. Yeah, sure.
That's fascinating because it reminds me of the sort of prophetic tradition that relates the man who went to a well and took went down, got some water, came out, and he saw a dog that was panting. Mm. And so he took his shoe and he went down and he got some water and he gave the dog water. And the Prophet, peace be upon him, said, you know, well, that's his pathway to heaven, basically, that in that kind of kindness. So that's fascinating. Other questions?
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
Anything you can tell me about Harvard? Was there any Muslims in Harvard? What was your first career? Anything you can tell me about Harvard? Vivid details.
Vivid. So I will tell you a story of the beautiful ways of the world. So I went to visit Yale for some random Muslim program in the mid-1990s when there weren't a lot of Muslims in Connecticut, you know, in the grand scheme of things. And I'd never seen a college campus like that and absolutely fell in love and found out I could take classes there and bugged my father to let me go. And now I understand why he didn't want me to live in New Haven because I would be far away from home, right? But I said, hey, I'm gonna have college classes from Yale. You can't say no. And he was like, oh man, you're right. So I went, I took courses, I got good grades, I got a recommendation from a Yale professor, applied to Yale and got rejected. That kind of hurt. Also got rejected by your alma mater, so that's another score.
They're lost. They're
lost. Yeah. And then, literally, 14 years later, I got an email from Yale University Press. Long story short, would you like to write a book about Islam for us? We've been following your work for a few years. And I said, you got to be kidding me. Mm-hmm. And my first decision was, I'm going to dedicate the book to the Yale Admissions Committee. Right? And so I'm like, this is your loss. So I wrote a book. They were writing a series on American religions, and they wanted me to write about Islam in America. So I wrote a book about Islam in America. And I submitted it to them. It took me 2 years, worked my rear end off, put everything I had into it. And then a month later, I got an email from them, thank you very much, but we're going to have to say no. I said, you asked me to write the book. Are you going to ask me to write the book and then say no? That's the worst thing in the world you could do. I was on 34th and 8th Avenue in Midtown Manhattan, and I was so shocked that I just started wandering. And I was like, I need to calm down. And there was a movie theater, and I was like, I'm going to watch the first movie that's playing, and it was I, Frankenstein. You ever seen I, Frankenstein? You've seen a bit of it. Okay, it's not like a particularly amazing movie. It was actually made me really sad because I was like, somebody made this movie and nobody's going to publish my book, right? Like, how is that even fair? This movie is like got millions of dollars in funding and the people who asked me to write the book won't publish the book. So anyway, in the end, that became my last book. And I found another publisher. I talked to Yale. They told me that it's either an academic book that wants to be a memoir or a memoir that wants to be an academic book. If you want to write an academic book, come back to us. If you want to write a memoir, you're going to have to find a different publisher. And I sat with it, and I thought about it, and I decided I wanted to write a memoir. And I ended up writing the book that I wanted to write, and a book that ended up doing quite well and opened a lot of doors for me. There are a lot of Muslims at Harvard. I didn't go to Harvard. But I think the beautiful thing about it, I'll say two things that are important. The first is, when you try really hard for something, you find openings and opportunities that you never would have had otherwise. And sometimes that means turning your back on the original one. You realize there's something better. You know, like maybe that book was not the book that I was meant to write, that one was. And the second thing I'll say is that you can't thank people in your life in the ways you might want to, but you can honor them by paying it forward. So my father and mother sacrificed a lot for me. My mother passed away many years ago. My father, he's elderly. He's like, you know, what can I do for him, right? Like, I can pray for him. I call him every day. But the way that I honor what he did for me is I pay it forward. So actually, you know, speaking of stepkids, for the book tour, I've been going to different college campuses, and I've been taking the girls who are teenagers in high school with me on the tour. And I want them to see different campuses. My parents couldn't provide that, not because they didn't want to, but because they didn't understand that part of American life. It was foreign to them. And so I honor their sacrifice by paying it forward. And I say to them, look, I'm going to take you to a nice school. Maybe you'll go here, maybe you won't. I want you to work hard, but I want you more than anything to just understand what's out there and start thinking, what do I want? What am I good at? What can I try for? And if you like something, think about what you need to do to get there. Hope that answers your question. And I hope you go to Harvard. And when you do, you will email me. Right. And I won't respond for a few days because I'll be a little bit jealous, but I'll be proud of you.
Yeah. If you're willing to share, I'd be interested in your personal relationship with God, if you can say there is such a thing.
Sure.
And then the reason I'm asking is, when you go to the really big cathedrals in Europe or the really big old mosques, I haven't been in the big old synagogues, you have this magnificent God on high feeling rather than a personal God feeling that you feel in some of the small chapels. So I'd be interested in your relationship, if that word is proper.
Sure, that's a beautiful question. I was fortunate to travel through a fair amount of Europe and through other parts of, you know, the Muslim world, Middle East, Egypt, Pakistan, so on and so forth, and saw a lot of monumental architecture. I actually have a passage in the book to this effect. And one of the mosques that affected me the most is it's the biggest mosque in Sarajevo, in the capital of Bosnia. And, you know, for those who remember, in the 1990s, there was a pretty terrible war there. About 100,000 people were killed. A good number were killed because they were Croatian, they were Catholic, and a larger number were killed because they were Muslim. And there's a long history in many parts of the world. You know, Muslims sometimes do it to other populations. We certainly saw that in recent years, genocides and so on and so forth. People can be horrible to people. And this mosque is interesting because it's the main mosque in Sarajevo, historically speaking, but by the standards of Istanbul or Cairo or Lahore, it's a very small mosque. Mm. It's not monumental architecture. No one's putting it on like a list of the top 10, you know, mosques of the world. And yet there's something so amazing about it because it survived through all this history. And I had a moment of prayer there early in the morning, and it was just me and a few other people, and they were all very confused as to, you know, who this brown guy is. And I remember thinking to myself that there's this assumption from the human ego that we honor God with a big mosque. And certainly, there's something to be said for simple logistics. If there's a lot of people in a place, you need a big building. But God doesn't actually have size, right? That's fundamental to the Islamic belief, is that the divine is outside of time and space. The divine has no dimensions. The divine is not big or small. The divine just is. And smallness can also honor the divine, the little gestures, you know? And I think that we lose that in a lot of spiritual traditions. And so for me, you know, I try very hard. I'm someone who's failed a lot spiritually and religiously and come up short in a lot of ways. And I try to tell myself that I don't know if, you know, with illnesses and so on and so forth, you know, you feel like you have only so many chances in life. And, you know, some people make the most of them, some people don't. And I try to honor actually exactly what Adnan said, is that, you know, is this thing a path to paradise? We have two rescue kittens at home. They're now over a year, so I guess technically they're not kittens. And they're the most ridiculous creatures in the world. You know, God only knows, like, why they exist. Because, like, they're, like, just endlessly amusing. And you know, and I think to myself that they are actually a door to God. That doesn't mean that I don't believe in prayer and all of those things, but I believe that all these little moments and gestures, you infuse them with purpose, and they connect you to something bigger. And again, when I say bigger, I don't mean in size, I mean in purpose. And so for me, I like to spend a lot of time alone. For me, the most profound moment is right after sundown or late at night, talking to God. And I will admit, being totally honest, it's sometimes a little transactional and very self-centered. I don't think I've graduated to the point where it's pure worship and pure adoration. I think that's for someone far more spiritually mature than myself. But I'm trying to go in that direction. And I'm taking baby steps on that road.
Comparing the way you grew up in the States, how you compare the difficulty to identify as a Muslim in a foreign country than the generations are coming now? Like, you know, how is it still the struggle to identify Muslims for the younger people here?
I'll be honest with you, I don't quite know. In some ways, I think that it's a lot easier. When I was growing up, we as a country have a lot of work to do on a lot of issues, but in some ways, we are better at representation, right? There were not many Adnans in America 20 years ago, right? Many colleges in the United States, including your future alma mater, Harvard, have Muslim chaplains, right? When I was in college, literally, like, one of the reasons I got to Adnan is because we would just ask each other questions, like, how do we, like, get, like, a holiday off, right? Like, how do we explain to a professor that, like, today's a religious holiday and we can't take an exam, right? Like, none of this stuff really existed. We were, like, really making it up on the fly. And in some ways, it produced this amazing, beautiful intensity because we had to read everything and we had to study everything. We had to figure it out for ourselves. And probably our answers were, you know, sometimes radically incomplete. But, you know, we're, like, 20 years old and just doing the best we can. We're pioneers. And the history of Islam in America is a history of pioneers going back centuries, right? And, I mean, you know, building on the peripheries of the Islamic world, you know, people who shaped the identities of hundreds of millions of people. And now, you know, you go to, for example, the school I went to, NYU, and there's not only a Muslim chaplain, there's a Sunni chaplain and a Shia chaplain and a mental health counselor, and there's, like, programs and a literary magazine and a theme month. So in some ways, it's much easier because you just insert yourself into this community and a lot of the work has already been done for you, and that's great. In other ways, it's more challenging because, you know, when I was growing up, there wasn't a lot of specific Islamophobia, right? Like, you know, there was racism, certainly was racism, right? But it wasn't targeted necessarily at Islam specifically. It was targeted at race and difference, right? Most people had no idea what Islam was versus what Hinduism was. It was just something else, right? And either you liked it or you didn't, right? And you know, I mean, we've obviously had problematic presidents, right? But in my lifetime, I can't remember a president who's so nakedly just malicious, right? And so I think about, you know, the kids, and I'm sure Adnan thinks about this too, like, what a weird world they are growing up with, that the first president they have a real memory of is Barack Obama, and the second one is Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, when I was growing up, we went from Reagan to Bush to Clinton, and obviously there were differences, but they weren't that different, right? Like, I don't know that many people who were, like, utterly crestfallen, you know, by the election of George H.W. Bush, right? As opposed to the stakes now feel truly existential. And so I say we live in an age of polarization. And so I think in some ways it's easier, in some ways it's harder. And I don't know which one will prevail. And actually, just to, as a final point with the book, we actually delayed it to wait for the 2020 election. Because we said, like, so much in the book may be so different depending on who wins and who loses. And I will say that that means that the future of Islam is one of a lot of challenges and a lot of opportunities. And it will require a lot of creativity and agency and flexibility because we can't simply assume that 5 years from now is going to be 5 years before us. It's going to be a very different future, and it's going to require people who are very confident in their identity, who are willing to take risks and try new things and willing to fail, and inshallah they succeed.
So I think that's a good point to end. We've come to the end of our time. Thank you for joining us in Philly, thank you all for coming out today to listen. And if you haven't had a chance to grab a book, please do. It's a fascinating read, and we look forward to your future work as well. So please join me in thanking Haroon.
Thank you. Thank you, Adnan.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.